Hello, everyone. This is Martin Willis. I'm your host, and welcome to Podcast UFO. My guest this evening is Ray Szymanski, and he is a Wright-Patterson Air Force Base insider. He was there for nearly 40 years, and we're going to be talking to him about all kinds of interesting things, and also his books, where he reveals a lot of this information. Also, he looks into some cases, such as the Travis Walton incident, Rendlesham Forest, and let's see, the other one is Incident Exeter. So he'll be coming up in just a minute. I want to thank everyone that supports the show, and anyone can do that over at Patreon. We have a Facebook page, lots of people on there. You can go over there at Podcast UFO. That link and other links are on our website. Speaking of that, we also have a blog by Charles Lear this week. It's a really a very long, intense blog about UFOs and balloons. Go check that out. And that's about it for me. Now, my guest, we're actually going to meet out at Contact in the desert, which, of course, is rescheduled. For I believe they're going right into 2021. They're rescheduling it for that time. Same for a lot of the UFO conferences. I know that I spoke with Alejandro Rojas the other day, and the International UFO Congress is the first week, I believe, of September. And they, at this point, they haven't canceled that yet. It's still on. You know, they will cancel it if they have to, but as of right now, that is still scheduled. We'll see what the next several months bring. Tonight, our guest, as I said, is Ray. I'm going to try one more time. Szymanski. There you are. Ray, welcome to the show, Ray.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mike. Don't worry. People have struggled over that name for centuries.
Centuries. Even in Poland, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Ray, before we get... Well, let's talk a little bit about your background. Could you please first fill us in with your background, and then we'll go from there.
Born and raised in Detroit, and went to University of Detroit, got a bachelor's of science in electrical and electronics engineering. Went to work for the Air Force in January of 1973 as a cooperative education student. And I worked there until my retirement, the last day of September in 2011. So actually, my career spanned 38 years and 9 months and five separate decades.
Oh, wow. And were you there at Wright-Patterson the entire time?
Absolutely. I was actually assigned to the laboratory, Air Force Research Labs. Now, it was their predecessors before they became AFRL, and Congress wanted to roll all the labs into one. But I worked for the predecessor called Avionics Lab, which eventually became the Center's Directorate. And I had spent time on loan to different organizations. So even though I was there at AFRL and my billet, as it were, was at Wright-Patterson, at one time I spent 10 years working for a program for the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering out of the Pentagon. And I'd fly there monthly to do reviews. Again, all my programs and all my money were being massaged and managed at Wright-Patterson. And then I did a two-year stint as the wellness director for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and I was responsible for the health and wellness of 12,000 civilian employees. And then for 3 years, I was the AFRL wellness director. So I was loaned out, executive loan program, on a number of occasions, but stationed at Wright-Patterson that entire time.
Wow. And your interests are, I do not have your book. First of all, you have two books, and they each start out with a similar title, right? Is that right?
Yes. Originally, it was called, a series was called 50 Shades of Grays, which was a play on words.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to make the titles a little bit more in line with the actual content. So just within the last several months, I changed the title to Alien Shades of Grays. But the first book is subtitled Evidence of Extraterrestrial Visitation to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and Beyond. and we can get into a description of that later, then the follow-on book, which was released about a year ago this time, is Victoria's Secret Truth, and that's a story of three generations of alien contact.
Wow. And how long have you had an interest in this topic, actually?
My very first week reporting to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base as a co-op student. Now you can imagine, I'm 19 years old. I'm kind of scientifically focused. I'm assigned to an office, and they assigned me a mentor. He's a mid-level civilian. So this is, he's probably a GS-11. And there were three buildings. They composed one large building, but there were two-story executive offices. And in the middle was a huge hangar, you know, informally with airplanes and people, you know, doing that sort of thing. And my mentor says to me, this is January 1973, he said, we're going to cut through that empty building and we're going to buy you a candy bar, kind of a welcoming gift. So we step down into this hangar and he turns to me and he kind of casually says, have you heard about our aliens? Now, you know, the two-story buildings that were the bookends of the large complex were kind of nice, you know, for government buildings. But we step into this dark, unused hangar, and there's these huge, you know, super thick curtains on them, and it's very dark. And this guy that I only know for a week turns to me and says, have you heard about our aliens? So I'm kind of like, whoa. So it's a 200-foot-long walk, you know, to get to the other side. And he starts telling me about this crash out west and how it had a machine that had occupants and they were brought here to Wright-Patterson. And, you know, that's where the conversation left by the time we got into the Greasy Spoon, which was where we got the candy bar. And that was like my baptism into Wright-Patterson's connection to this whole alien thing. So it's been a long time ago.
Now, was he really like just trying to bust your chops? You know, because you were new, or what? What did you get? What were your feelings right off the bat? Did you think this guy is just, you know, just kind of trying to break me in and, you know, haze me a little bit because I just started? You know, what were your thoughts?
I think a little bit of that, but at the time, you know, this was 1973. Project Blue Book had been there for 22 years. Mm-hmm. Along with its predecessor, Sign and Grudge. So
yeah,
the history of Wright-Patterson hosting Project Blue Book was well known. There was the TV show. A lot of focus was put on that project by the local press, the media, television. You know, there were crews always trying to come out to do, you know, little bits for the news. So it was very well known. That connection was very, very well known. So I think it was kind of something that they were proud of, that, you know, it had international fame. So that story, you know, that connection helps elevate everybody. And then again, I think it was a topic that many of them were interested in. Al was an intellectual. And in fact, you know, there's GS, like grade 1 to grade 15. If you get congressional approval, you get to become a civilian at the flag rank. So you're the equivalent of a general or an admiral. Believe it or not, Al went on to become a member of the SES. So when he retired, and he had worked for many years at that level, he was actually the level of a flag officer. So this was not a dummy guy that was telling me about this. So I didn't know he was going to eventually attain the highest rank that you could ever attain as a civilian. But it kind of tells me in retrospect that, you know, the guy was thinking about it. He was an intellectual, and, you know, those are the kinds of things that they talked about around the water cooler.
Yeah. Now, if there were, in fact, you know, aliens there, first of all, that would be something that would be surely classified. And that this is what I'm just getting at, you know, when you talk about a conversation like this. That's why I asked you, you know, was he busting your chops, you know, right off the bat? but this type of information would definitely be classified and, you know, would not be able to be, you know, he would not be able to talk to you about it if he had was told this is classified, top secret, you can't, you know, discuss this. So what did you think?
Well, I think now that he was a mid-level engineer, he and a lot of the guys that I eventually wound up talking to, like Doug in accounting and all those guys that, you know, he regularly lunched with, and they kind of drew me in under their wing. I think it was a topic that they were interested in. The connection was very, very well known. I don't think any of them were ever read into the program, obviously, because that was not the type of office. We were more of a, you know, management kind of computer support office that very first session that I was there. So I'm thinking that those guys were very interested. They were soaking up all the news. They were probably reading the books and that sort of thing. But I think very few people on the base would have actually had hands-on knowledge of what was really going on there.
Right, right. And I'm sure the topic Roswell didn't come up as far as, you know, I mean, a crash out west, something like that, I understand. But, you know, that topic was kind of, I want to say more or less obscured for many years until Stan Friedman back in 1978, I think it was. Was it 78? I can't really remember when it was.
Yeah, I think he got Marcel to talk in 78.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, in between, you know, Roswell kind of faded away real quickly right after the incident itself, when it was passed off as, you know, a weather balloon, and just people kind of moved on from there. Of course, there were a lot of UFO sightings right after that. But still, that was kind of obscure for many years. Did the word Roswell ever come up before 1978 that you're aware of?
You know, I would say no. And the way to check is buy a copy of my book and read it, and you'll find out that I don't believe I mentioned Roswell in the book. I believe the quote that I remember is he said that there was a crash out west. Now, here's what I did. You know, there are moments in your life where, like, you almost get into an auto wreck, or, you know, the birth of your first child, or whatever it is. There's moments that you don't really forget, and you may be a little hazy on some of the details, but the core story is going to stay with you. So I found Al, and I communicated with him. He suggested I write him a letter, and I did. And what I wrote him in the letter was my recollection of our conversation that day. And Al got the letter, and I said, Al, I'm thinking I'm going to write a book, and I want to put this in there. So you are free to adjust anything you want, anything. And if it's reasonable, if your recollection is strong, I'm going to make the changes. Well, he sent what I sent him. He sent my letter back to him, and he wrote a thing, and he says, you know, Ray, as you know, I retired as a flag level civilian, and I can't allow you to use my last name, and any changes are in the text. Thank you for, you know, remembering. And I went to the sheets of paper, I think it was maybe three and a half, and the only place he made a change is he wrote in there, and I said something about the aliens and their wreckage, and he said, I can neither confirm nor deny that there were aliens. Mm-hmm. That's the only substantial change he made to the entire dialogue. So, and he's a pretty thorough guy. He had to be. He was a member of the senior executive service. He was, you know, those guys make big decisions all the time. So I think he gave a careful consideration, and his recollection was as good as mine, and he only made that change. And so, you know, I have that as my physical evidence of my communication with him on that topic. But again, there was never a mention of Roswell. It was like there was a crash out west, and that's the way I wrote it up.
Yeah, yeah. And that's good to hear. So when you worked there and you did you just go, do you remember like what type of impact that had on you? Was this something you just kind of tabled and then maybe discussed it with people later on? How did that go?
Well, I initially wanted to check out Al because Al was, I want to say, a loose cannon. You know, he was his own guy, and, you know, he didn't dressed the part like a lot of people did. He did crazy things, like he showed up every day with a briefcase. And the only thing he had in his briefcase was a sandwich for lunch. But he wanted to look the part. And everyone would laugh. There goes Al with his briefcase. And so I found out, you know, who he was lunching with. And once in a while, he'd invite me in. And we go to a place called the Airway Inn across from the base. And there was Doug. And I can see another guy with dark hair whose name I can't remember. I know what city he lives in. But there'd be a handful of folks. And when Al wasn't there, I would drop by and go, hey, Doug, like, you know, Al told me this thing about this crash and UFOs. And Doug would go, yeah, like, of course. And I never got any pushback on it. I got, like, everybody had this nice, easy knowledge that this was part of base history. And they just accepted it. Or they might go, hey, you know, there's going to be a new documentary on or a TV show. Or go, you know, I've read this book. Or, you know, they might share books amongst them. So the handful of people I asked, at least then, you know, satisfied me that there was something to it. But you can imagine, you know, I'm in college. I'm an electrical engineering. This is not a pushover, you know, English major courses. So it really never became a focus. And I might ask, you know, I got involved in sports on the base, softball and basketball and volleyball and that sort of thing. And I might ask my teammates occasionally, hey, you know, what's this, you know, UFO thing? And then, of course, you know, in the late 70s, Stanton's book hit the fan. And, you know, by the early 80s, there was like, look at, see, you know, we told you. But again, it really didn't become all consuming for me until the Phoenix Lights.
Oh, okay. Before we get into that, I always forget that we do have a lot of new listeners to the show. I get enough email to know that for sure. People are going to may wonder, what is the connection between Roswell and Wright Pack?
Okay, the connection, definitely. Well, the connection is that Jesse Marcel was a major, and he was an intelligence officer at Roswell. And they sent him and another intelligence officer with the rancher, Mac Brazel, and they sent those two up with Brazel to retrieve the crashed material, whatever it was. They brought it back. They looked at it. Colonel Blanchard was the commander of Roswell, and then he told Walter Hout, who is his public information officer, we've got a crashed flying disc, and Walter Hout then gave it to the Roswell newspaper that the Air Force had this UFO. Well, the next day they changed their story, and they said it was just a crashed weather balloon. Now, fast forward 29 years later, and Stanton Friedman gets connected through friends of Jesse Marcel's with Jesse, interviews him, and Jesse says things like, it wasn't this planet, we tested it, it was no material that I know, and it was flown to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for inspection. Then you had the chief of staff, who was a general up at the 8th Army Air Corps. Now, that was in Fort Worth. And he was in the office into which Jesse flew those materials right after the discovery. And this general said that material was flown on a plane that General McMullen owned. McMullen was chief of staff. Some went to Wright-Patt, some went to McMullen. When McMullen was done with it, his private plane took the rest of it to Wright-Patt. So what do we know that's immutable? Whatever the material was, it went to Wright-Patterson. And the reason it did is the materials directorate was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. That was the world-class group of scientists who knew anything and everything about aerospace materials. That laboratory had been set up in 1917 at Wright-Patterson. So by 1947, they had 30 years of experience. It would have been the place to go. So The guys who handled the material, the guys who were responsible for getting it transported, all said it went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
I see.
And that's the connection.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I just thought of, only thought of just now, but, you know, when they published in the paper that the Army Air Force had captured a flying disc, but when you when they talk about, when anyone at all talks about the wreckage, it certainly doesn't sound like a disc at all. It sounds like fields of debris. You know, maybe they're assuming that it was a flying disc that burst into this field of debris. But I don't know. I just thought of that because that's all you ever hear about the crash site. It was just like, you know, 100 yards of or more of debris just scattered around. They never, as far as I know, they never really captured any disc-like object out of that debris.
I hear you, and the debris was scattered about a half mile long.
Oh, half mile.
And yeah. Okay. A half mile, and you know, 1,000 feet wide. And wow. The witnesses, Marcel, said it didn't look like an object had hit the ground, been dragged, and went into pieces. It looked like something exploded in the air and then fluttered down, because that's just the way the debris was scattered. Yeah. On the other side, there are witnesses who say, well, there were sticks and whatever. Then you flip-flop again. The guys who are supposedly hand-on witnesses, like Marcel, said, we couldn't tear it, we couldn't bend it, we couldn't burn it, we hit it with a sledgehammer, we crushed it, it came back like today's knit and all material would do. So it exhibited properties that were not consistent with the weather balloon explanation. So you've got data on both sides that doesn't jibe, but you also have enough data on the side of a crashed object that makes it possible.
Also, there was a story floating around, you know, you don't hear this all the time as part of the story, but something like 60 miles away or something like that was another object that they thought possibly was related to this that was found, like the size of a Volkswagen Bug. These are just things that I remember. And the bodies supposedly were there. And, you know, I believe Stanton Friedman thought that that could have meant that it was a mid-air crash between two vehicles. I believe those were, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but something that he believed that was about. It's confusing. You know, as the years go by, you know, Roswell can turn more into a myth than anything else, you know, as far as the story goes. Who knows what it will become eventually, but as of right now, there's a lot of stories. It's really hard to figure out what the facts are in this case, especially since, you know, the witnesses are long gone, or almost all of them are. There's one or two living at this point, I believe. Interesting.
Yeah.
Have you ever actually gone to that area or looked into
yes.
that? Yeah. I understand
with my metal detector.
Oh, you actually went to the site?
Sure.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I know a lot of people have. How did they, is that marked off? How do you find it? Is it just through a GPS or something?
The Sci-Fi Channel has put a marble marker on top of the little nub hill there. Yes, they did a program, and then they planted the marker. The problem is that in order to get to the site, which is owned by, like, the National Park Service, you have to go through private property. And unless you get permission, the ranchers tend to shoot you, because if they have their cattle in that field, you have to go through the field, and you know, people have left the gates open and the cattle have gone down the road. So wow. It's really hairy. It's a hairy place to get to. And if you go through the national park, or, you know, whoever owns it for the government, it's like a 40-mile drive over the roughest roads ever. So it's not easy to find.
Yeah, and so this is, I would assume that people are going to try to get there a lot over the years. But so you have to, like, if someone plans to actually go to that site, for instance, for yourself, what did you have to do? We've only got about a minute before we go into break.
No comment.
Well, I had to stretch it out for that minute.
Okay. Well, I can tell you this. I can tell you this. I detected metal on the site. but I did not dig it. I did not excavate it.
And is that a taboo thing to do? I mean, do they say no digging?
I think the guy, last guy who admitted to taking stuff off the property, they tried to take his stuff away and
Had
to fight it. The guy who's from New Mexico State or University of New Mexico or somewhere, I can't recall his name offhand, but I'll look it up here at the break.
Yeah.
But it's a hassle with those people.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. I remember that whole story. That was a couple of years ago. All right, everyone. So we're ready to go into the break. So this is Martin Willis. My guest is Ray Szymanski, and we'll be right back right after these messages. Yeah. So we were just finishing up on Roswell, and let's move on to some of the stories that you you cover. You actually, I believe, you go in as a skeptic.
Well, for my new book, it's a story of three generations of contact. And the grandmother is in her mid-50s, and she has a daughter, and that daughter has a son. And Victoria is her name, and so we named the book Victoria's Secret Truth. Now, when somebody tells you that they've had contact with creatures that they don't quite understand, you ask yourself, how do I find evidence? So I'm a former research scientist. That's how I spent my career. And so I'm trying to find facts so I can move forward. So on the physical end, what we decided to do is we looked at anything medically. And so Victoria gave me information that could be backed up by medical records that would indicate that perhaps there were some pregnancies there that never came to term, that in fact her eggs were being taken from her ever since she was a small child. She has a scoop mark, much like many abductees have, that looks like about the size of your pinky, the little top portion, and you could stick the bulbous part of the pinky in there. Many abductees have those scoop marks. So we looked at the physical evidence. Then Victoria has had four hypnotic regressions with three of the world's best hypnotic therapists. Dr. Leo Sprinkle, who wound up eventually reading my manuscript and wrote the foreword for the book. Dr. Sprinkle has regressed thousands of admitted abductees. The second person who did a regression of Victoria was Barbara Lamb. Barbara's famous for her regressions. She's also done thousands of people. The third person who regressed Victoria, I'm drawing a blank. This is really crazy. Yvonne Smith. She's going to kill me. So Dr. Sprinkle did two of the regressions. Yvonne did one, and Barbara Lamb did one. Now, what I did as I was reviewing the information is I had discussions with Yvonne Smith, with Barbara Lamb, and with Dr. Sprinkle, and brought them kind of into this, you know, discussion, circular discussion about Victoria. I asked them questions about being able to fool three world-class hypnotherapists, what they thought of their sessions with Victoria, their analysis of it. Victoria let me share sessions that, therapist A got to see therapist B and C and round robin so that they could all see what was happening. And, you know, I got the thumbs up that this this therapy, this regression, all of these are consistent. The story is consistent. And in some cases, the therapist asks these tricky questions, like Victoria would say, the aliens were green, and intentionally, Dr. Sprinkle would say, tell me about these blue aliens. And immediately Victoria would say, no, they were green aliens. And there are circumstances of each time these therapists did that as kind of a check to see if the story could be influenced. And in those sessions, she was airtight. And I tried doing the same thing. I had over 40 hours of interviews with Victoria. And trust me, I asked her a loaded question. I'd slip things in. She never made a mistake. She never contradicted herself. It was clear as a bell. So as far as a witness is concerned, my confidence is soaring in Victoria's story. So the book focuses a lot on her. And then she has a grandson. And her grandson's now about 8 or 9. And her grandson has had visitors that he drew pictures of for her, and that he described conscious memories of what they did to him when they visited him. And those visitations with him continue today.
Wow. And so you said 3 generations, and you were you able to speak to all 3 of them, are you saying?
The daughter is currently not cooperating.
Ah, yeah.
She doesn't want to hear it. She doesn't want any part in it. And I just got to respect that.
Yeah. Okay. But so through her mother says, yes, she has talked about it, or she doesn't want to be interviewed. How did that go?
From whose perspective?
I'm just saying, how did you know that she was part of this, as far as the abductions or whatever, if she didn't want to talk about it?
Yeah, well, you know, you talk to the mother and you get some answers, so.
I see.
And they were very, very, very limited.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
At this point, I know it's a certainty, but, you know, I'm respecting her privacy.
Sure. And when the grandmother, or the first generation, when did she when did these things start happening to her? What year?
This would have started in the late 60s, when she was actually living outside Cincinnati. And the fact of where she lives is a kind of a cornerstone of the story, because she was a young girl of about 4 or 5 when she got what she referred to as her alien scoop, even when she was a youngster. And she remembers visitations of entities in her room.
Hmm.
And she actually has conscious memories of seeing a spaceship when
really?
She was
wow.
very young.
Yeah. You know, there's not a lot of people that will talk about things happening back at that time, but there are a few. You know, I mean, that's back when the Betty and Barney Hill incident happened. There's also been other situations. For instance, Kathy Martin has told me, who she is the niece of Betty Hill, and she was saying that it was generational. There were some things that were happening generational in her family. I believe she said it was either her mother, and maybe possibly her grandmother, that had some of these experiences. I hope I don't get that wrong, but I do believe that's what she told me. So it is that always has been an interesting aspect. I've been on the fence a lot of times on some of these, you know, so-called abductions or encounters, experiencers, but it is interesting how it seems to be a generational thing. And if you had to speculate, I know you have a science background. Speculation is not what a lot of scientists want to do. But what would you speculate would be the reason why it would be generational?
Well, I think they chose the first person maybe because of their environment or genetics. Let's take Victoria, for example. There was a place in southern Ohio, just north of Cincinnati, called National Lead of Ohio. It was also called Fernald. And they made enriched uranium products for the nuclear weapons program. Unfortunately, the contractors were not paying attention to what they're doing, and they eventually discovered that the people who ran that plant spewed over 1 million pounds of radioactive waste into the air, the ground, and the water. Victoria, and you can look up at national, if you look up, just type in NLO and nuclear, it was the worst nuclear environmental, I don't want to use the word accident, event in this country's history. The cancers that have been caused, studies have been done, are astronomically higher, the cases per capita than they should be. It's incredible. But Victoria only lived 5 miles due west of the Fernald plant. Now, her mother worked at the Fernald plant, and all the workers were exposed.
Wow.
Her mother died of a radiologically induced disease, and her brother also died at an early age. I won't speculate on his death, but I think if I had enough time, I could probably tie it back into the fact that he was in his mother's womb while she was in the factory, and so was Victoria. Now imagine you're somebody who's trying to find a human being who appears to be not immune, but not as affected by nuclear radiation as the average human, as appears to be the case with Victoria. So now you're somebody from another planet, and you go, well, we really need to create hybrids who have some self genetic protection against this radiation thing. So Victoria would be one of those, because in one of her regressions, the entity that's got her on the table and is examining her is telepathically asking her, why are you so healthy and your mother and your brother were not? It's a huge clue as to why Victoria may have been chosen.
Wow.
So now, genetically, you've got a good baseline subject to start with. Somebody who may be not as affected by all that stuff that blew out of the NLO plant. So I'm just guessing, it's an educated guess based upon all the research I did on Victoria, her family, their history, their medical history, that may be the reason that she was selected, that she turned out to be healthy despite the fact that she was downwind of this stuff for her entire childhood while that plant was active.
Now, you say downwind. Doesn't the wind typically go from west to east in that
and
area?
She's 5 miles east of the plant.
Oh, east. I thought you said west. I'm sorry. I mixed that up.
Now, okay. Yeah. If I did say west, I would have said the plant was 5 miles west. But, yeah, she was downwind.
Ah.
And I've checked all of the weather patterns and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, if you look at the weather patterns from where the wind actually blows, it's about 45% from the west. And then the rest get divvies up, southwest through northeast.
Yeah. Wow. This is totally off topic, but just quickly, did they ever really clean up that horrible disaster? Is that all cleaned up at this point?
Yes, and then they developed a diddly squat amount of money they're paying these people, if they're long dead, the relatives aren't getting anything. I know who the attorney is for the class action suit. Contacted them. I've chatted with them, but I hooked him up with Victoria to see if anything could be done. Nothing they could do.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's a travesty all the way around.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What was your kind of your conclusion? So you think something really did happen to this family, and something's actually continuing to happen to this boy. How old is he now?
Oh, I would say probably 8 or 9.
Oh, really?
It started when he was about 4.
Wow. Wow, that's something. And so your other book, I believe you talk, into each case. There's 3 cases you go into. As a skeptic, you're trying to debunk them. One of them is the Travis Walton incident. One is Rendlesham Forest. And one is the Phoenix Lights. Is that right?
Exeter.
Oh, yeah, that's right, Exeter. But it's Phoenix Lights that really moved you to decide you were going to look into this. Is that, am I wrong? Did I get that right?
Yes. And here's why, Martin. When the Phoenix Lights came out, they contacted Luke Air Force Base and asked if there were any jets chasing a UFO, with which witnesses reported. And Luke Air Force Base said, no, there were no planes. And then it became flares being dropped. And then, well, I became incensed at the response of Luke Air Force Base's public information officer, because it made the rest of us working for the Air Force look stupid.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, look at Roswell, I can give you. That wasn't even my generation. I don't care. But now you got a sighting where 100,000 people have got it on film, and police officers, first responders, you know, everyday Joes, but people who are really sane and don't want the publicity, and they're saying we saw it. And then the Air Force is going to come out and go, yeah, I mean, I know we can't use the weather balloon thing anymore. So how about some flares? Y'all going to buy the flares thing? And they made some thing up about a tent, and that was BS. And at that point I said, you know what? I'm jumping in with both feet. I'm going to find out for myself. And that's when I really started to dig. And I, you know, called in some favors. I talked to some intelligence people in the Air Force, showed them some things. And I got some very positive, encouraging responses from them. I thought they would stonewall me. That's not what happened. In fact, I think they wanted to know as much as I did about, you know. And it was like, hey, keep me posted on this Phoenix Lights things. But I got some help from quarters that I really didn't think I would get any. And that's what really got me going. And I started to do some field research. And eventually I wound up going to Exeter and finding new witnesses and old witnesses, and visited the sites and had some unique, advancements there. Into a story I wanted to debunk, but I actually kept finding more evidence.
Yeah. Just 1 second, go back to the Phoenix Lights. That I think was March 13th or something like that, 1997. And so it is possible that there was some military flares, but that only accounts for a short period of time. People were seeing these, you know, this big thing flying over them. Some people even guessing up to 8 miles wide, or at least miles wide, which is pretty amazing. And so the military is, or the Air Force is saying that it was just military flares. And you were on the inside, basically, contacting them because you were able to reach people. And how was your interaction? And then we'll go on to the Exeter story. But how was your interaction with that?
Well, the guy went public, because the public information officer, when he issues something, now, you know, he doesn't really issue anything. What happens is the commander, the base commander, says we've been contacted, tells the public information officer what's the response. They'll contact the public information people up at the Secretary of Defense's office and say, what do you want us to say? Here's what we're proposing. Yeah, they get it approved. It goes back down to Luke Air Force Base, and then they do the release. Well, the Department of Defense has a thing called a global address book. So when you're on the inside and you're there and you've got your CAC card in your machine, you can access everybody's email address. So I knew who the PIO was. I looked him up on a global and sent him an inquiry and kind of got stonewalled. And then I got mad and I go, stop making us look stupid. Please, you got to come up with something better than that. Or how about the truth? And totally stonewalled. And I know other guys in the building did the same thing, because it's like, look it, we know you've got to make something up, but you're making us look really dumb.
Yeah.
So stop it. And of course, now they're going to stonewall us. They won't talk to us. But at least I got the satisfaction. I got the bark at him at least once.
Yeah, that's right. There was this story of a fighter pilot that went up and looked at it, and he was absolutely shaken from what he saw. And it would be so interesting to be able to figure out who that was and be able to talk to him. That would be amazing. But I'm sure that's a situation where you can't talk about it, because it's, I'm sure everything was top secret and classified with what he saw. But anyway.
I can imagine.
Anyway, for the listener that's just first starting to listen and find out about this topic in general, check out the Phoenix Light. There's a lot of really good information online about that. There are a couple of movies that are not exactly, they're kind of theatrical movies that is not really the real story, but if you look into it, you will see a lot of really good information on that. So we have just 3 minutes. We'll start getting into, before we go into break, that is, before we do, though, go into break, you want to start talking about Exeter. You actually traveled to Exeter, New Hampshire.
I did, yes. Yeah. I went to Exeter, and I tried to find some of the old the sites that were mentioned in Incident at Exeter, written by John Fuller.
Yeah, yeah.
And he wrote that whole story.
Yeah. And as far as witnesses, I know the main witness died in, I think, in 2001 or something like that. I can't remember exactly when. Are there witnesses left to actually talk to there?
Yeah, actually. It turns out that Clyde Russell owned the Russell farm, and next door was a man by the name, his last name was Dining, D-I-N-I-N-G. And in between the Russell farm and the Dining farm is a large horse pasture, a couple of acres. And on the night of September 1965, Norman Muscarello was walking up Route 150 going into Exeter. He's hitchhiking, coming from a friend's house. And he got in front of the Russell farmhouse, and up hovering over the garage and the house was a 90-foot UFO. And I did my research, and I found out where that house was, and I eventually visited that in around 2008. And who did I find living there but Clyde Russell's son, Arthur. And Arthur knew the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And Clyde Russell and his family was made famous in the book Incident in Exeter. And when we come back from the break, I can tell you about how I spent the day with Clyde Russell and the witness that he introduced me to that gave me some additional information on that particular incident. It's really fascinating.
Wow, that's great. Okay, everyone, we're going to go into the break now, and we'll be back in just a few minutes, so hang in there. So, Ray, when we went into break, you said that you were going to continue. You spent a day with a son from Incident Exeter, one of the farmhouse, right?
Yeah, 1965, Norman Muscarello was trying to thumb a ride as he walked up New Hampshire Route 150 on his way back home to Exeter. And it was very, very dark. And if I've actually been out on that road at the same time of year with no moon, and you cannot see your hand in front of your face. So he's trying to flag down a ride. He's now in front of the Russell farmhouse, and out behind a tree line pops this object that Norman always called that thing. He never called it a craft. He never called it a UFO. He always said that thing. And it had these lights on it. It was like a 6-5-4-3-2-1, 1-2-3-4-5-6. And that's the way the pattern was. But it was hovering just a few feet over the farmhouse and the garage. So Norman, thinking this thing's going to fall and crush him, runs across the road, dives into the narrow channel there, and the UFO backs off. He makes it into Exeter Police Station. Somebody actually picked him up. He was hysterical. Guy by the name of Reginald Scratch Tolan is the desk sergeant. Norman spits out this story, and he says to a guy by the name of Eugene Bertrand, a police officer who had just come to check in, he said, "Gene, go out there, take him to that field, check it out, and, you know, if there's nothing there, come back." So they get out there. They're out there for about 5-10 minutes. They don't see anything, and now they want to head out of that field and come back to the squad car when that thing reappears. It hovers less than 100 feet over the head of police officer Bertrand and Norman Muscarello. Well, Bertrand, being a highly trained defender of civil liberties, pulls out his revolver, gets down on one knee, aims it at the craft, and then went, "No, not today."
Reholstered that was a good move.
His gun. Yeah, it was. He grabs Norman, and they run to the squad car. And he gets on the squawky. He goes, "Scratch, I see the sink. I see the damn thing myself." Well, as he's talking to Scratch back at the office, David Hunt, another patrolman, pulls up. They go back into the field, and now all three of them watch as that thing heads out towards the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
So that's 1965 September. Fast forward decades later, I'm in the Exeter area, and I done my research, and I figured out through internet searches where that farmhouse was. Now, that'd be 65, 75, 85, 95, 05. You know, this is almost 50 years later. I don't expect to find anybody there who knows anything. I get there, and who do I find is the son of Clyde Russell, who was there all those years ago and who was made famous in a book. It's his son, Arthur. He's 80 years old. I tell Arthur who I am. I'm an Air Force guy. I'm interested in a story. What does he know? He walks me through the entire story. When you get my book, you'll see I've got a photo of Arthur in there, and he's actually pointing where Norman was standing. He's pointing to the place where that UFO was hovering over their farmhouse. He toured me through the property, showed me where the UFO was most likely hiding during the daytime, introduced me to neighbors who had stories but couldn't come forward for the author, John Fuller, because they were in positions of prominence. One that he introduced me to was the head teacher at the Exeter Academy.
Hmm. Prestigious academy. Yeah.
It is. He knew what was going on but couldn't say anything. He eventually purchased the Dining Farm. Now, why is that important? Because in the John Fuller book, he describes the horses, as were described by the police officer and Muscarello, making a huge noise in their barns, like they were kicking it in. When I talked to this former teacher at Exeter, he told me that when he bought the Dining Farm, the horse stables where the horses were was still kicked in.
Wow.
It had never been repaired.
Mm.
And indeed, that night when that UFO was hovering over that farm field, over Norman and those two police officers, the horses were kicking in their barns. And he was the first guy to verify that in an interview that I did with him in 2008.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was one of my revelations. I was like, yeah, I'm not going to find anything. And yet I got people who've come out of the woodwork.
Yeah. I grew up, I don't know, maybe 10 miles away from that area. Vaguely remember hearing about it. I was on the main side, but maybe 15 miles away, something like that. I vaguely remember hearing something about it, but never really, you know, looked into it. Of course, when I was growing up, I thought this was an interesting topic, but never really looked into anything. But now, there was a There was something about a woman at a traffic circle also during that incident, right? Someone who her car stopped or something?
She was driving down the road. And in John Fuller's book, the name of the road is defined in there. It came and hovered over her car, and her car stopped.
Right.
And it floated out in front of her, and she got to witness it for several minutes.
Yeah.
And if you go through Fuller's book, there are dozens upon dozens of witnesses. And in the end, Pease Air Force Base is within about 10 miles of Norman and the police officer saw this. The commander of Pease came out and tried to tell the people who were gathering every night in the field that what they were seeing were tankers refueling airplanes.
Yes. I remember that. That was their whole reasoning behind, their whole debunking of it. And that didn't fit with any part of this, really. I mean, that's in a high altitude, for one thing. When they refuel. They're not at low altitude, as far as I know.
Well, you tell the three people, including two police officers, who saw this thing hovering 100 feet. And when the Air Force tried to debunk those two police officers, one of whom was retired Air Force, when the Air Force tried to debunk those guys, they wrote the Air Force an angry letter back.
Oh, I never heard that part. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a great story, and that's one of the real good ones. And I've gone to the celebration of that. They have is put on by something like the Lions Club or something like that every year. There, speakers come in from all over. It's always fun. And it's still not that far of a drive from where I live. I've gone there a number of times. And last time I went, Stan Friedman was there. And, as many times as I've heard him speak in person and on this show, I always loved hearing him talk. He's great. He was great.
He was.
Big loss. But is there anything else you can add about this particular sighting you found out while you're researching it?
Yes, just that. And I have talked to some other folks who actually were witnesses to it and tried to avoid the limelight. None really wanted to talk on record. And I thought that, the fact that they hid and the community knew. But I'll tell you a little incident that happened.
Incident extra?
I had been there. That's right. Very good. Just to let you know that it was still in the consciousness of those people. I was there at night, and I was investigating. And on my last night's investigation, I had parked where I had been on a couple of other nights. When I went to park in my parking place, which was this little cleared moat area, someone had parked a 25-foot-long Komatsu front loader, along with road scraping equipment, brushes and everything else. And I thought, I'm being warned away. These people don't want me to park here. So I squeezed my car, my rental car, in between the front loader and all the stuff they had scattered on that grassy area and the tree line. And while I was sitting there, I took a photo of the stuff for posterity. I hear a female voice coming through the window of the driver's window. I'm not parked. The road is on my left. And a woman's voice says, "Hi." Now, it was so dark, Martin, I couldn't see in front of my face. And so it was just a disembodied voice. So I said, "Hi." And the lady says, "Well, what are you doing here?" Now, you imagine my shock. I did not see or hear a car pull up next to me. So maybe she just snuck up on foot. I don't know. But I couldn't tell because I couldn't see 3 feet. So I said quickly, "My name is Ray Szymanski. I'm from the Air Force. I'm here to reinvestigate this thing, and I want to see what it was like the night Norman was here." And she stops. She cuts me off. She said, "They're not coming back. There's nothing here for you to see. You need to leave." Now, imagine what's going through my mind. It's late at night or early in the morning, take your choice. And I have a female voice on a lonely country single lane road telling me to leave the area. Now, you and I, all right, you got a female voice, but you could be some hulking person with a gun. I don't know because I can't see you. So I thought, well, maybe she didn't understand what I said the first time. So I went through my story again, and she cuts me off and said, they're not coming back. There's nothing here for you to see. You need to leave.
Weird. It's generally a very friendly area, very friendly people in the whole area there. So, yeah, that does sound kind of strange.
I had waited years to go there and do the investigation. I'd spent a couple of years just researching it, knowing I had a few days and exactly what I was going to do. Now, I grew up in Detroit. And I'm pretty tough. I spent a lot of time on the streets, five brothers, you know, tons of buds in the neighborhood. And I thought to myself, you know, you've waited all this time to do this. Are you going to let some disembodied female voice scare you away? So you know what I did?
What?
I got my skinny Detroit butt out of there as fast as I could.
Did you actually, now, if you go over to Pease now, Pease is all taken apart and it's, you know, a commercial building, but there's no way you could actually speak with anyone over there. But I wonder if there was ever a record. Now, I know at Betty and Barney Hill, there was actually a record at Pease Air Force Base. Did you, were you able to research or try to research any documents on this as far as Pease?
No, but again, when you read my book, my first book, what you're going to find out is that during the time of the incident at Exeter, Pease Air Force Base was home to the 509th Bomb Group. Does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah.
They're the same group from Roswell who dropped the atomic bombs. Well, they had been transferred to Pease. And so Pease was storing nuclear weapons. So if you want to know what the UFOs were doing around that area at the time, a really good guess would be they're checking up on the nukes that Pease was housing.
Wow. Do you know where I grew up? I grew up on top of a hill called Winter Hill. It was a property that was a single farmhouse on top of a hill overlooking the river. And directly looking at Pease Air Force Base. So I could sit on my porch or sit on the upper hill, and my sisters and I often did because we saw like weather balloons and stuff like that from there. And we would watch the planes land over at Pease. It was probably, as the crow flies, as they say, probably 5 miles away, but you still could see them Wow. coming out, you know, landing and flying. And anytime there was the Blue Angels there or something like that, it was a lot of fun. Living where we did. And there was also a crash. I remember being sitting at the dinner table and all of a sudden the lamp on the ceiling moving back and forth. It was a crash, F-18 or something like that. But it's funny, when in the 60s back then, when there was, I guess there was a UFO wave or flap in that whole area, I do remember sitting out with my sisters on the lawn. We were looking for UFOs. And then, you know, over the years, I kind of forgot about all that until I actually had a sighting. But have you yourself ever had any type of sighting?
A sighting?
Yeah, UFO sighting.
Yeah, you cut out momentarily there. I've actually had one that I can say 100% for sure was not ours. And then I had one at long distance. So the most important one was 2011, first week of December, I was coming back from a physical therapy appointment because I had been in a car wreck a year earlier, and I was kind of, you know, on the mend. So I was coming home, and we had a really low ceiling. You know, some days we get a ceiling here 100 feet. And I was coming home, and something light broke. It was very overcast, low ceiling, but a shadowy thing broke the light of my moonroof. And I only live a few miles from Wright-Patterson, so I'm used to that happening all the time of planes coming in, especially now with, you know, with the war going on. And But the thing that struck me is despite the fact that the window was closed, my shade was pulled open, but I didn't hear a noise. And usually, you know, I got a C5 going over, the car shaking. So I thought it was unusual. And I could just tell by the way the light happened that it was going to come down, and I could look through the front windshield. And when I looked down, I'm trying to stop for traffic at a traffic light. And what I eventually estimated to be a 90-foot wide craft. I got about a 7-second look on it. And in my first book, Alien Shades of Grays, there is a photograph of that intersection, and I took a graphics program and I drew in what I saw. And I saw the tail end of this craft, which was about 90 foot long. So that's a 100% no doubt it wasn't ours. And then a handful of years earlier, I was doing some satellite watching using the Heavens Above website. Yep. It tells you where all the satellites are going to be.
Right.
And it was July. It was beautiful, crisp, clear. I was looking to the west, and there was this big, bright satellite came in. And then I realized it had two objects with it. So they kind of form like an angle like this. So you had one super bright object here, the satellite in the middle, and down here was another super bright object, and they tracked across the sky as one. And it was mind-blowing, but it was obviously up at the height of the satellite. But imagine, you know, if the satellite's supposed to be there by itself, what's next to it?
Yeah.
And it definitely was not the space station, because I checked all the, you know, sites, and, you know, it was on the other side of planet Earth at that time. So there is no explanation that I have for those three lights. And the two that were kind of like escorting it were like arc welding intensity.
Wow.
And the other one was, you know, standard, yeah, reflective satellite kind of stuff.
Wow. Yeah. I know that... a lot of times you will see a fairly bright reflection. I'm sure you know that from the sun as a satellite's going. But it goes out eventually, or it dims, or, you know, as it's passing through the shadow of our planet. Bobby, who's calls in now and then from North Carolina, had sent me a video that an astronomer took of the moon. I'm going to look into it more. It looks pretty amazing, but I don't know what it is. It almost looks like a fleet of UFOs going over the surface of the moon, shadows across the moon and everything. It's pretty interesting. Again,
yeah, that's been debunked.
I was just going to say, again, there's so much CGI out there. Is that what it is? Is it
Mark
CGI?
Mark D'Antonio, yeah. Who's a CGI world-class expert,
yeah,
he debunked it in massive amounts of technical detail. Mark will make your head spin.
Yeah, no, I've known Mark for years. Yeah.
Yeah, he went into every aspect of it, and he flat out debunked it.
Oh, that's good to know. So another one Bobby sent me. This is like the second or third one he sent me has been debunked by Mark. But, it's well done for the average person, you know, that is skimming through YouTube, and I say, watcher beware if you're looking through YouTube. This is how I'd put it. I would say that UFO videos on YouTube are guilty till proven innocent. That's the best way you can put it, really. I wouldn't trust...
put it this way.
I wouldn't trust too many of them.
Don't.
Yeah.
Don't.
Yeah.
Don't waste your time.
Right.
Get a good Stanton Friedman book, you know... Don't waste your time on YouTube. It'll drive you nuts.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So let's talk about, I don't know, you said you also have Travis Walton in that book as well. I've known Travis for several years. He's someone that I actually trust and have looked eye to eye and had a discussion with, many discussions with him. And I know you did too. So let's talk about your situation with Travis.
Well, I was at the International UFO Congress, and I met Jennifer Stein, and she had just wrapped the movie Travis.
Yeah.
And I had told her that I was a photographer, and I was going. I didn't have the GPS coordinates of Travis's site, but I'd researched it for a couple of years, and I had a pretty good idea that I could find it on my own. And she said, "Ask me what I was going to do up there." And I said, "Well, I just want to do some research. I like to go and kind of get the feel of the site. I want to look around." And she said, "Well, if you would do me a favor and take some photos of these tree stumps up there, I know somebody who can help you find the site." So I said, "Sure, I could use some help." And next thing I know, she's yelling over, "Hey, Travis, get over here." And Travis was down the other end of the table. We were all eating dinner. And so he comes up, she introduces me. And a couple days later, Travis and I got him in the back of my 4x4. And we're driving through the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest. And he's directing me right to the site of his incident. So we spent a very cold February afternoon. He's showing me where the site was and what tree stumps to shoot. And eventually, the little research project that I did for Jennifer got incorporated into the movie Travis.
Let me ask you this.
Did
this have to do with the unusual tree rings?
Yes. The growth is exponentially larger for each of the trees in the direction of where the UFO was hovering. It was like a magnet, like it sucked the trees toward there. And now I did a lot of research about what can cause that. And it turns out that for any of the reasons, the natural reasons to actually cover it, the growth would have to be in the same direction. It would be like water availability, wind, several other natural phenomena. But since they were growing towards a centroid, a center point, you could throw all of those excuses out the window. So I went up there with Travis. We spent the day doing that. And then it was really weird. It was getting late. The sun was going down. And we're standing at the point where it happened. And he starts telling me about it. And he said, "Can you see that road down there?" And I said, "What kind of?" He goes, "Well, it's really not used anymore." He goes, "That was an old logging road." He says, "We were coming up that road." He goes, "And we were looking in this direction because we thought we saw a forest fire." And he's pointing and he's telling me. Now, I'd spent that afternoon, with a ladder, scraping, chiseling ice off of these tree stumps and taking photos and logging in my book and drawing them and, doing the researchy thing. And he starts to tell me the story. And it was just like one of those holy moments. And he's telling me the story about driving up and how he got out and everything that happened. And there I am at the site with the guy, and he's telling me the story. And then I get to look him in the eyes and like ask him a couple questions, and you can see him reliving it right there. And of course, I include that in Alien Shades of Grey's and some other things, because Travis can be a funny guy and we had some funny things happen. And there's more to Travis than just that incident.
Oh, yeah.
And I include a lot of that in the chapter.
I found Travis to be very intelligent, first of all. And I've had many conversations with him that had nothing to do with his incident. And he's really there is a lot of layers to that onion when it comes to Travis. He's very, very interesting guy. The thing that I got out of that, the whole incident or whatever, that the two things that I think are really strange is the eyes of the aliens, if you want to call them aliens, whatever they were. That was the scariest part for him. He said that the eyes were, just staring at him just scared the heck out of him, and I also asked him, I don't know if you asked him about the movie Fire in the Sky, what he thought about it. Did you talk to him about the movie? Because I know there were some definite differences in the real story.
Yeah, I think what I remember is, first of all, he told me he had a cameo in it and where to find it. So there's a town meet. There's a town meeting, and he's in the back of the room, and they actually pan across, and so he's in the movie.
I never knew that.
He did a cameo, and then he just told me that it was a very loose Hollywoodization of the story, and he was happy that it got attention, but the core story is good. They just played loosey-goosey with a lot of the facts.
Yeah, and the fact that he thought he was on board for such a short period of time, and it was 5 days he was missing, right?
I believe
it was 5 days. Yeah,
5 days.
Yeah, and do you agree that you think that it's a solid story? I mean, solid to me.
I tell everybody that the Travis Walton story is in the top three, if not number one. And, I'm a believer in hypnotic regression up to a point. And, there's so much negative you can throw at it. But think about it. A hypnotically regressed memory is legally admissible in a court of law. So if you're trying to come up with a detail or more of the core story, that is admissible in a court of law. So if you think about this, you had seven guys, one who had the physical evidence, on his body, and you had six witnesses with absolutely zero to gain and everything to lose, and each one of them passed multiple detector tests. The strength of that story, as far as I'm concerned, is irrefutable. And then look at how hard people like Philip Ass tried to debunk that story.
Yeah.
Philip No Class.
Yeah.
I call him Philip Ass. And others, if it didn't have any basis, they wouldn't have wasted their time. I mean, they offered a guy $10,000. And,
Steve.
They did everything they could. So, the old smoke and fire adage definitely applies here. For me, it's slam dunk city.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, when I talked to him about being regressed, he was regressed one time, I do believe. And he said that he never wanted to do it again. He's scared to do it again. If I have my facts right, I do believe that's what he told me. It may have been someone else. Do you know what about that situation about him being regressed?
I understand he's been regressed at least once, and I never heard the fact that he wouldn't do it again. But knowing what I know about regressions and what comes out, people actually relive that. I mean, you can, if you can find John Burroughs regressions, I think Linda Moulton Howe had them. When John Burroughs was being regressed, it's scary. He's a Rendlesham witness. He was out there.
Yeah.
He was shaking. Peniston was near that also. So, these people are reliving it. And I'll tell you this about Travis. I maybe had a handful of conversations with him in my life. The longest was the day I spent with him. I literally spent an entire afternoon. We went to dinner that night. He came back to my room after dinner. We had coffee and tea. We chatted for an hour. But every time I see him, I look in his eyes, and he's reliving that every moment.
And there's a lot of pain there. He has told me that there's been many years where he wanted to just step away from this, and kind of put it on the back burner and not have anything to do with it. But he also gets involved with people online that are bashing him. He'll directly get involved and reply to, some people trying to debunk the case, which I think is, that must be hard to do for him, because, you get involved with people that are bashing you, like trolls. I have some trolls sometimes. I just let them do their thing and let them go, forget about them. But anyway, the lines are open, and for those of you on YouTube, you can see it up on the screen. The phone number, 855-472-5483. If you're over at KGRA Radio, that number one more time is 855-472-5483. If you have a question for our guests, feel free to call in. So you spent this time with Travis, and you said that the tree stumps, that is something that you, because I had heard about that when it happened, when they discovered those tree stumps and the unnatural formation of the rings. Was that something that you actually discovered, or did they find it before and just want you to photograph it?
I had discovered that through my research. Somebody else had discovered it because they cut down and they did, some investigation. But when they filmed the movie, they did not get any still shots of those trees, and they really didn't do any kind of evaluation of the site as a whole. You know, they just looked at these things as onesies. And when I went in there, I recognized the pattern. And then I did all my measurements, and Travis pointed where the craft was. And so I wrote a report for Jen Stein. I forwarded it to her, said, do with it as you wish. And then it was incorporated, a couple of the photographs, and they reused my analysis, but they prettied it up and did some other graphics to it. And so they took my data and made a story of it and incorporated it into the movie. So not my original discovery, but my kind of advancing that into a more solid factoid is where I made a contribution.
I see. We do have a call coming in. Our screener is not picking it up yet. There he is. Okay. So we're going to be taking a call in just a second. So as far as that case goes, I think it's a solid one. Now, they were talking about doing another theatrical movie on that, like an updated movie. Have you heard anything about that?
I haven't, but I wouldn't bother. I would get Jen Stein's version of the movie called Travis. It has Travis in it. They're at the site. They've got the other guys that were involved in it. It's very factual. It's not quite documentary. It's not the entertainment. You know, the James Garner as the sheriff guy coming in. But it's very entertaining. And, we need more of the Jen Stein kind of approach and less History Channel, where they've got a storyline and that sort of thing. So I really enjoy Jen, and I would recommend anybody who wants, like a real easy version, do that. But get Travis Walton's book, Fire in the Sky, and you can order one, and he'll autograph it for you.
That's right.
So order it online, tell them you want it autographed. But it's a brilliant piece of work, brilliant.
Yeah, and he has a website for anyone out there. You can easily find, I think he even puts his email on his website. He was telling me all the people that he gets constantly, it's pretty interesting, are emailing him and calling him. I think he even puts his phone number on there. I don't know if I'd do that. But anyway, we have Ryan calling from South Carolina. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hey, Martin, how you doing?
All right. Good to hear from you.
Thank you for the T-shirt, by the way. It came.
All right, finally.
T-shirt!
Yeah. Uh-oh, he wants one. You got a question for our guest tonight, Ryan?
Yeah, I do. I guess I'll keep my thoughts on Travis Walton to myself. But anyway, to get back to the Wright-Patterson deal, I wanted to ask him his thoughts on Hangar 18 and if that's in his book.
It's not in my book. During my talks, I do that. I discuss it, and I'll tell you. I actually canceled a talk that was scheduled for the 6th of May in Myrtle Beach. It was going to be at the North Myrtle Beach Library. I show up there every year and give a talk, usually the first week of May. So check my Facebook page for next year. Anyway, Hangar 18, here's my thoughts. I don't believe we need a Hangar 18 for Wright-Patterson and its connection to UFOs to actually be true. And here's why. The materials that they described, the largest piece that was picked up outside Roswell was about 2 foot long. Easily you could put that in a briefcase. And anyone who handled that said that was the biggest piece we found. Most of it was maybe 2 inches by 3 inches. So the way it would have gone down is somebody would have put several pieces in a briefcase. They would have brought it to the headquarters of the materials lab, they would have said, you know, we're from this agency. Here's some money. Here's the materials we want you to look at. And we're going to come back in 6 or 8 weeks. You tell us when we can come back. And we want you to write us a report on everything you can tell us about this material. Do you know where it could have been manufactured? What kind of metals or fabrics that it was made out of? Just soup to nuts, you tell us about it. Those guys in the black suits would have come back several weeks later. They would have gotten any of the pieces that weren't destroyed in the testing, recollected them, gotten a report, paid the lab for their time and said, this is classified top secret. Thank you. You're never allowed to talk about it again. So you really don't need a Hangar 18 for the story to be true. But since you called in, I will tell you the building that I think is Hangar 18 if there was one. How's that for a deal?
Okay.
One day I was looking at a Wright-Patterson Air Force Base map, and I was looking at it north to south, east to west, and it was properly positioned on my table. And there was a big hangar there that at one time was a temporary hangar for the Air Force Museum. And it also houses about 1 million square feet of Air Force Museum stuff. It's where they store things that are being worked on, which will eventually make it into the museum. Well, I happened to turn the map around, and I realized that I was now looking at, before I was looking at buildings 8, 1, 9, and 2. And when I turned the map around, one of the hangars was no longer designated as 81. It was designated as Hangar 18 on the map. So that was on the old flight line. And if the material was flowing from the 8th Army Air Corps in 1947 to Wright-Patterson, it would have flown into Area B. And that hangar would have been one of the hangars, one of the best hangars for that bomber, the B-28 or 18 or whatever it was that brought the goods in, to just drive right in. So if there had to be a Hangar 18, I know which building it would be, but I don't think it's necessary.
How about that?
Yeah, I think the significance of 18 in it was the fact that it turned out years later, one of the rumors about Building 18 or Hangar 18 was that it was storing bodies, and you know, a lot of people scoffed at it, you know, but it turned out years later that there actually were freezing chambers in there, and the building manager said it was to test components for cold startup and things like that. But that was, I always thought that was kind of interesting, but yeah, I don't know that I buy any of that, but I always thought that was kind of interesting. It did turn out there were freezing chambers in Hangar 18.
You do have the right history, but you have the building wrong. See, there's building 18 A, B, C, D, and E. And in the middle of those building 18 complex, which is owned by the Propulsion Directorate, is a hangar. And that hangar is numbered 23. So despite the fact that the only hangar in that group is in the middle of it, it's always been building 23 or hangar 23, yet it's surrounded by five buildings that have a building 18 designation. And that's where the confusion comes in. But you're right, that building 23 did have those cryo tanks in order to freeze components. You're absolutely correct.
Hey, Ryan.
Actually,
Ryan, don't go yet, Ryan. Because everyone has, a right to their opinion. So I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on Travis Walton. You mentioned something about him. Don't be shy.
Okay. All right. I don't be shy. By the way, before I get into Travis, let me see. It was 18F, at least, that I had heard it about. But anyway, This building appeared in the classic episode of In Search Of called UFO Cover-Ups in 1980. Anyway, moving on to Travis Walton, how do I put this? Travis, he seems sincere. He has a lot of witnesses and everything, but I have the same issue with this UFO story that I have with pretty much all the UFO stories. And I'm sure, you know, someone can say technology is the answer. I understand that. The issue I have is they get kidnapped. They get taken aboard the craft. They can breathe these aliens' air. They handle their atmospheric pressure. They say their ears, they don't even say their ears pop when they're taken aboard these crafts. They notice no difference in gravity. I mean, it's almost like wherever these aliens are from, they have the exact same conditions as Earth. And I've always found that a little hard to swallow, and I'm sure someone can come up with some kind of technology explanation. You know, the aliens put some kind of invisible, you know, suit around them or something like that. But at that, to me, that has been the hardest thing to swallow in all these stories, because, I mean, you go up on a plane here on Earth and your ears pop. I mean, when the astronauts, for example, went to the moon, they, were, of course, were wearing just endless amounts of protective gear. Otherwise, their heads would have blown up. Anyway, that's just my two cents on those abductions.
Well, I find that interesting, because I have thought of that as well, Ryan, and I've also thought of, you know, how can these beings, you know, be here on this planet, you know, for, here's a good case, we have a virus now, but I mean, they could contact anything that we have here, you know, I mean, that's the type of things that I have thought of. So I don't think that's a silly thing to question. I think that's, you know, that's a good point.
With them, it's a bit more believable, because, you know, they could have, you know, some sort of, they could be wearing some kind of invisible magnetic field or some kind of technology on their belts or something, or some kind of suit we can't see or anything else. But the human being taken aboard, that's the hard part to swallow.
All right. Well, maybe there is an answer. I mean, there is an answer, but what the answer is, I have no clue, and I can't say, you know, what you're saying is silly or, by any means. I think it's interesting and a very good point. So I do appreciate it, Ryan. And
yeah.
All right. Have a good night. We have another caller. So talk to you later, Ryan. Yeah. Thanks for the call. All right. Our next caller is Steve from Washington. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys.
Hi there.
One question. I've heard over the years that Wright-Patterson did a lot of reverse engineering. Is that true? Is there a group at Wright-Patterson that had done reverse engineering every time they get a Russian plane or any other kind of technology?
Hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I worked in the labs, and, you know, for many years, the Foreign Technology Division, they're now called NASIC, they did not have much of a native capability to do the research. What they would do is they'd say, okay, you know, we picked up a piece of metal. We don't know what it is. We're going to give it to the materials directorate. And so they give it to the lab experts. They find a piece of propulsion. They all give it to the propulsion lab. So they have thousands of experts just within the Air Force lab. Then you got the Navy labs and Army labs, and you have contractors that you could just give whatever it is you found and have them examine it. So absolutely, you know, they've done reverse engineering from day one.
Well, I'm not into like Roswell at all, but that's the story with Roswell. The stuff went to Dallas and then went to Wright Path to be reverse engineered, isn't it?
The Foreign Technology Division's charter is anything that is in the sky that we need to know more about, we need to get a copy of it. And then once we get a copy of it, we need to understand it, like how to defeat it, how to defend it, how to use some of the technology that we don't have and put it on ours, how to exploit it. So, yes, they're always doing reverse engineering, I'm sure, of every aircraft that's not ours, including those that are off planet.
Yeah. Interesting.
That should not be a secret.
Is that it, Steve?
Okay. Well, one other thing, you flashed over the Phoenix lights and you seemed to scoff at the flares. And I'm just curious, is it your view that there were no flares on the night of the Phoenix lights event?
Yeah, it's like Martin and I discussed. There are too many events to be explained, and maybe one video of somebody who was videoing the flares would explain it. But the fact that this 3-mile-wide V-shaped craft was going over, 100-mile run north to south and then south to north, seen by tens of thousands of people, could not be explained by a simple dropping flares. And even that was weak, because when they did the analysis of flares versus what was captured on video, the light signatures were not the same. So it's just too weak of an excuse. The flares can basically explain like 3 minutes, and that leaves like 1 hour and 58 minutes of sighting yet to be explained.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, the Phoenix Lights event into two parts. There's the 8:30 event, and then there's the after 10 o'clock event, where the military went up and dropped a big array of flares, an array the size that Phoenix had never seen before. That's why the local story was so big. And that 10 o'clock flare drop was captured by 5 different cameras around the valley, and that's what made the news all over the place, all over the world.
Yeah, a lot of the films you see are the flares.
Now, the flares, yeah, they might have made the news, but there were dozens of other videos taken that also made the news. So, again, flares stayed up for like 2 minutes, okay? So they would have to have 60 flare drops, okay? 60 separate passes. There was one flare drop. You've got 2 minutes of coverage. Explain the other hour and 58 minutes. I disagree with you vehemently.
Right, but if you watch I Know What I Saw, there is actual video of the real craft that went over.
Yes.
At 30 that night. Okay? That's the only real video. All the other videos are flare drops that took place after 10 o'clock.
Not true.
I've actually heard the same thing from a number of people that have really looked into this. I don't know, but I have heard.
Yeah.
I've heard that, Steve. You're not the only one saying that. And I know they're saying, some people have said Dr. Lynn Katai's video is the flares. I don't really know. I don't want to say, because she's. But I don't know. But I think it's time to move on. We have another caller. Thank you very much for the call, Steve. And we have Shane. Shane is calling from Kentucky. Hi, Shane. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Martin. Thank you for taking the call. I would like to ask your guest. I think he said that he lives in Ohio. Is that correct?
Yes.
I was just wondering if you had ever investigated or just what your thoughts are on the Lawrence Coyne case in 1973.
Oh, yeah.
Which case is it?
The Coyne helicopter case.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. The one up near Akron.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes. My son lived up there for a couple of years. I tried to find some witnesses. I tried to get some people from the National Guard to come forward. I really, because I was only up there for like a couple of days at a time and I had family things, I really didn't break any new ground. I really have nothing to report, but I think that's a pretty, compelling story with, a guy who knows his career is done as soon as he tells that story.
Yeah.
As soon as, you're a pilot and you're saying, I lost control of my copter. It flew up 2 miles and, we were tractor beamed and this light was coming. Any pilot, commercial or military, will tell you, the minute you come forward with a story like that, you're flying a desk. So I think just from that standpoint and the fact that the whole crew, their stories were consistent, to me, it makes it a pretty strong case. But I don't have any unique insight, or, you know, I didn't really find out anything I could add to that.
Anything else, well, Shane?
I agree. I think it's a very, very reliable case. No, that'd be it, Martin. Thank you.
All right. All right. Thanks for the call. All right. So we've got about five or so minutes left to the show, 4 minutes, I guess. So let's jump quickly into the last story that you looked deeply into. And on the when you and I were off air, I told you my thoughts right off the bat is I think Rendlesham Forest is a very convoluted story. There's a lot of twists and turns and, you know, different accounts. What did you find when you were looking? Again, you're looking into these particular stories as a debunker, trying to debunk them. And in a four-minute session, what can you tell us about Rendlesham Forest?
Well, I contacted some of the key witnesses, Colonel Hall, John Burroughs, and Jim Penniston. I also went to Rendlesham. I did my look around. I wanted to follow their footsteps, so I read everything I could, and then I went forward. And I tried to find the locations where they were. I took a lot of photographs. I talked to some local people who had a little bit of knowledge. But again, I didn't get a satisfactory response like I did when I did Exeter, when I found real witnesses. So I contacted Colonel Hall. I met with him in person. I met with John Burroughs, and I've had some really good exchanges with Jim Penniston. And so I can tell you that based upon all those interactions, I also think that's a top three case. I am delighted with Jim Penniston's new book. And I am because he's a guy who was in the middle of it. He touched the device. He felt it. He drew it. He photographed it. He was there with John Burroughs. Everybody knows that he was the guy that went forward. You know, unlike Larry Warren, who's a bit controversial, whom nobody can remember being out in the field. Maybe Bustenza is the exception, but nobody can remember him. And, you know, you saw that fallout, you know, with him being disavowed by his author and everybody. So I've had good exchanges with Jim, and he's been very open with me. And in fact, he and I had planned to get together at Contact and sit down and have a chat. But I find his book insightful, compelling. It is the definitive book on Rendlesham Forest. And don't just read the paragraphs, you know, the story. Read the footnotes. They are probably more informative to the reader than the general story. You'll get the general story and you'll get all the factoids. Go to the footnotes. And so Jim and I, we still, I asked him some questions just about a week ago. You know, we message on Facebook and stuff. I just found that to be a rock solid case that's being told by some very rock solid people. And you don't need the regressions that they took, which of course are corroborative, but they've been very consistent and they're not afraid to be combative with each other over the facts until
that's right.
They come to some agreement. So I think that's a strength too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I find all their stories very interesting you know, just that there are some, you know, different stories, you know, but I know they were also messed with, you know, during their debriefings, you know, drugged and such. So we are at the end of the show. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure talking to you tonight.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on your show.
All right. Okay, everyone. So that's it for the show tonight. And so thank you so much for checking us out. And remember to be back next week. Our guest is PJ Hughes of the Nimitz case. So make sure you come back and check that out. Same time as always. And I want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. Anyone can do that. And over at Patreon we are. And guess what? Next week is our 400th show. Yes, our 400th show. So I guess I'll have to give away a t-shirt or something. But everyone, I want to say thanks again. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.